Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Michael Zweig, professor of economics at SUNY Stony Brook, who assesses the failure of the Wall Street bailout plan in Congress and alternative government intervention that could assist working class Americans. Melissa Draper of the Democracy Center, who reports from Cochabamba, Bolivia, on the origins of violent clashes between supporters and opponents of Bolivian President Evo Morales. And Brooke Suter of the Clean Air Task Force, who discusses Connecticut's successful campaign to clean up dirty power plants and how the lessons learned are now being applied to similar efforts across the U.S. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Egypt's most prominent dissident, Saad Eddine Ibrahim, visited Washington, D.C. in September and spoke with key supporters such as Kansas Republican Senator Sam Brownback and Massachusetts Democratic Senator John Kerry. He urged the legislators to place human rights conditions on Washington's annual $1.5 billion aid package to Egypt. On August 2nd, Ibrahim was sentenced to 2 years in jail with hard labor by an Egyptian court for his columns that ran in foreign newspapers for allegedly tarnishing the country's foreign reputation. However, he has not returned to Egypt since June. Ibrahim has served three previous sentences from 2000 to 2003. Former U.S. Ambassador to Egypt, Francis Ricardioni Jr., dismisses Ibrahim's push in Congress as totally idealistic and not a useful tool of diplomacy. The Mubarak government has stated it rejects human rights conditions on any foreign aid. Egypt is the second largest American aid recipient since the country signed a peace deal with Israel in 1979. Senator John McCain is basing his presidential campaign largely on his patriotism and being tortured as a prisoner of war in Vietnam. Yet McCain gets poor grades from veterans groups on providing health care, education benefits, and housing to returning veterans. The Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America has given McCain a D rating on 155 votes since the September 11th attacks, including the Arizona senator's absence during the debate to create a new GI Bill sponsored by Virginia Senator Jim Webb. In contrast, Senator Barack Obama got a B-plus grade from the veterans group. In 2007, Obama sponsored the Home for Heroes Act to provide housing for low-income veterans. According to the news magazine In These Times, McCain has opposed a series of veterans' initiatives over the last 3 years that were funded by reductions in tax cuts to the wealthy. In 2006, McCain voted against a bill by Hawaii Senator Daniel Akaka to boost veterans' health care by $1.5 billion and $480 million for veterans' outreach services. The same year, McCain opposed a bill by Connecticut Senator Chris Dodd for new funding for crumbling veterans' hospitals funded with a rollback in reductions to the capital gains tax. Soon after, the Washington Post exposed the appalling conditions at Walter Reed Army Medical Center in the nation's capital. For the second time in 3 years, voters in South Dakota will deliberate over a ban on abortion. Yet there are some changes on the ballot measure from the total ban proposed in 2006. Ballot Initiative 11 permits exceptions to the ban in cases of rape, incest, and a narrow definition on endangering the life of the mother. Dr. Marvin Buechner, a South Dakota doctor specializing in high-risk pregnancies, says the ballot question is effectively a ban because of its stiff criminal penalties. The Rapid City doctor told the Washington Post, "There is no way I would consider doing an abortion under Measure 11 for health reasons." South Dakota already has one of the most restrictive abortion laws in the country. Doctors must tell all pregnant mothers that an abortion can increase the risk of suicide, a fact disputed by pro-choice forces. Pregnant mothers must also be shown a sonogram of their fetus. To rev up the campaign for Measure 11, conservative churches allied with the Lampstead Project are planning an aggressive outreach effort. The project's Reverend Steve Hickey claims abortion is unnecessary in part because the church is a significant part of God's provision to women and children in crisis. Hickey says he believes South Dakota has been chosen by God to challenge Roe versus Wade. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Ruben Abreu.
In the wake of Congress's failure to pass a Wall Street bailout bill and the steepest drop in the stock market in 20 years, many economists say that the U.S. is witnessing the most serious financial crisis since the days of the Great Depression. Despite appeals by President Bush and both presidential candidates, the House rejected the $700 billion bailout proposal, the product of negotiations between Democratic and Republican Party leaders, by a 228-205 vote. 60% of Democratic representatives supported the measure, while only one-third of Republicans backed the plan. The fallout from the subprime mortgage meltdown has caused the failure of a succession of banks and other financial institutions. The latest victim being Washington Mutual, the largest bank failure in history, which was placed into government receivership, then sold to J.P. Morgan Chase. In another deal brokered by the government, Wachovia is set to be acquired by Citigroup. Economists warned that if the federal government did not take action soon, a credit freeze could make it difficult for consumers and businesses alike to borrow money, resulting in a seizing up of the U.S. economy with disastrous ripple effects across the globe. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Michael Zweig, professor of economics and director of the Center for the Study of Working Class Life at the State University of New York at Stony Brook. Professor Zweig examines alternative priorities that could guide government intervention to stabilize the economy while assisting the over 1 million additional homeowners who will face foreclosure in the coming months.
Hank Paulson's claim and his proposal, that two-and-a-half-page proposal, was sort of the equivalent of Condoleezza Rice's, you know, mushroom cloud claim. And we have a situation in which people were being stampeded, or at least that was the attempt on the part of Paulson and Bernanke and Bush administration. And having been stampeded once into foreign policy and military catastrophe, I think that people are starting to think, well, maybe we should look at this a little more carefully, and maybe we should really make sure that this is necessary, that it'll work, that there is an exit strategy, if you will, and also that we take into account the needs of sort of working people, which this plan didn't do to start with, and as far as I can tell, still doesn't do.
Is there some great danger that if the federal government doesn't step in here soon, that we're going to see some kind of calamity that we've only read about during the Great Depression?
Well, I'd have to say that nobody really knows. However, I think that it's fair to say that the country does need a well-functioning credit market and a financial sector, and that it doesn't have one right now, that the credit markets are frozen up, that people can't get loans, refinancing their mortgages, expanding their businesses. There's just a tremendous fear among financial institutions that no one's credit will be good, no one will be able to repay their debt. And that's because nobody knows the value of what's on anybody's balance sheet that has anything to do with these fake securities that were pushed out into the market over the last several years. So there does need to be something that happens to rectify that distress in Wall Street. I think that there isn't any real question about that. Whether throwing $700 billion at it or $250 billion at it, with the tremendous authority and independence that the Secretary of Treasury would still have, despite the oversight, fairly distant oversight that's being contemplated in this legislation that failed today. So I think that it's fair to say that this is just another example of how the needs of Wall Street and the needs of the corporate elite just pull the oxygen out of any other discussion, any other concern for economic issues that might affect what's called Main Street, but really is working-class people and middle-class people who are trying to get by during the day, who have jobs that are very difficult, that don't pay very well, who have jobs that don't provide them with health insurance, are losing those jobs, losing their homes, and this bill doesn't do anything about that. And I think that people are saying, wait a second, if we do need to do something about Wall Street, let's do it in a balanced way. Let's do it in a way which serves the interests of working people and serves the interests of the real economy and is not just something that throws a bunch of money at Wall Street so that they can get bad assets off their books and then go into the sunset, tra-la, with wonderful assets and no liabilities, and everything will be fine. That's not the way to do things, and I think that the Congress is in some remote way sensing that and has backed off.
Certainly for the last couple of decades, we have seen the predominance of trickle-down solutions. You know, give to the wealthy and somehow that'll trickle down to the middle class and those below. That hasn't happened. We've had an increasing gap between rich and poor in this country that we haven't seen in many generations here. As you look at this current financial crisis, again, the predominant establishment solution aims the big money at the top and not the bottom. Just referenced. Is there a viable solution that could bail out people at the bottom with these subprime mortgages to help them out, not to get a free house or anything like that, but just to enable them to meet payments every month and hang on, or sell off and get a rental if that's all they can afford without losing their shirts? Is there a viable way to do that?
Well, there is for a very large number of those mortgages. For some, probably not, but for a very large number, if there were guarantees for these mortgages and if there were government backing for the renegotiation of these loans when they come due, so that instead of resetting to become more onerous, they could be reset to become more affordable, and you just set payments that people can actually make, then I think, yes, you could save many hundreds of thousands of homes. Now, we'll see whether Congress is able to reformulate a package that does deal with the needs of Wall Street, which are real, to get the credit markets going, but to do it in a way which begins and ends with the interests of working people in the United States. And we do have, from our report, Economic Stimulus and Economically Distressed Workers, we do have a proposal for a package that would get us towards full employment in the United States, increase the economic activity of the country, which would generate jobs, which would generate income, then also some structural reforms. So it's not like nobody knows what to do. It's just a question of what's the political will, what is the social organization and force. All of those communities that need to get together and really push forward a progressive economic agenda.
That was Michael Zweig, professor of economics and director of the Center for the Study of Working Class Life at the State University of New York at Stony Brook. The center's new report, Economic Stimulus and Economically Distressed Workers, can be read online at their website at sunysb.edu/workingclass. A deepening crisis has gripped Bolivia as that nation's first indigenous president, Evo Morales, works for the approval of a new constitution. Violent clashes between the president's supporters and opponents in recent weeks has claimed more than a dozen lives. A constituent assembly approved a new Bolivian constitution last December, although the session was boycotted by the rightist opposition. The new charter, which nationalizes resources, guarantees the right of the indigenous majority access to land and basic services such as water, education, health care, and electricity, is scheduled for a national referendum vote on December 7th. In an August 10th recall election, scheduled to break the political stalemate, Morales won 67% of the vote, up from 53% support in the 2005 presidential election. While two opposition governors lost their seats, four of Morales' main opponents survived the recall vote. On September 9th, anti-Morales protesters looted and burned many government offices in Santa Cruz, an opposition stronghold in the resource-rich eastern lowlands. On September 11th, more than a dozen indigenous Morales supporters were murdered in Pando province. The president arrested Pando's governor, charging him with ordering the killings. Morales also expelled U.S. Ambassador Philip Goldberg, accusing the diplomat of conspiring with opposition groups to undermine his government. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Melissa Draper, assistant director of the Democracy Center in Cochabamba, Bolivia. She talks about the origins of the violence and negotiations now underway between Morales and his opponents to reach national consensus and end the political unrest.
We've seen violence lash out here as of September 9th, and it's really been building for many months. There's a strong opposition movement that is based in the four eastern lowland provinces of Santa Cruz, Beni, Pando, and Tarija. And the governors of those four departments have stood up against Morales and his intended agenda for change and trying to bring more equality throughout the country and give powers back to some of the indigenous poor, which, as they say, have been marginalized for centuries here. So we've got a large landed elite in the eastern lowlands who don't want to respond to changes that Morales has suggested in the Constitution, which would include a massive redistribution of land and would also allow him as president to be reelected. So they're concerned about the shift in power here. It's a strong shift, as we've seen in the August 10th referendum on Morales' mandate, which gave him a 67% approval rating, but also kept those four opposition governors in power as well. So we've got a basis of serious exchange of power and concern for the fact that the indigenous majority might actually be gaining more of this power, and that might affect some really deep-seated privileges that these eastern lowland landed elites that are primarily of European descent might see a change in their position.
President Evo Morales expelled the U.S. Ambassador Philip Goldberg on September 10th, I believe it was. He was charged with supporting opposition governors and groups that have committed some of this violence. Tell us more about that expulsion and how many facts back up the charge that this ambassador was meeting regularly with these opposition groups and that money was being siphoned off to them.
Ambassador Goldberg was kicked out just in reaction to that violence that we saw on September 9th in Santa Cruz. And Morales' basis for that was supposedly because Ambassador Goldberg had just met with one of these eastern lowland governors, one of the opposition leaders, as well as the Chuquisaca governor. And that was right around the time that both of those governors came out and denounced Morales and also just around the sparking of that violence. There has been a tenuous relationship in general between the Morales administration and the U.S. Embassy, but this is obviously the height of it. Unfortunately, Morales did not go through any diplomatic channels. He kind of spontaneously announced it in a talk he was giving to supporters. Unfortunately, it's going to lead to some serious repercussions here in the country, of which we've just seen proposed cancellation by President Bush of Bolivia being a beneficiary for this APDEA, which is the trade preference that's very important for the textile industry here in Bolivia. And we're going to see some very upset Bolivians because of that. I have to say that I do not think Ambassador Goldberg acted very diplomatically according to how tenuous the situation was. Surely he can be supportive of dialogue, and the U.S. should be supportive of dialogue and negotiation between these two very extreme camps. And it was not appropriate for him to be meeting with opposition leaders, even if he wasn't inciting the violence. It was perceived as though, by many, that he was.
What's the current state of negotiations between Evo Morales' government and opposition leaders? We've heard that the negotiations had started and that they will continue sometime later this week.
Yes, that's right. The negotiations started here in Cochabamba, where we are, on September 18th, and so that was a big step forward in terms of calming the potential for more sparks of violence across the country. But right now they're in suspension, and that's primarily to give two of the four working groups more time to work out some of the details associated with the distribution of the hydrocarbon gas taxes and the autonomy issue, which is addressed in the Constitution. Those two working groups requested more time, and so President Morales and one of the leading opposition governors agreed to suspend the negotiations until the 5th. So this Thursday, they'll come back together and hopefully proceed with an agreement.
What are the chances that Bolivians will get to vote on a December 7th referendum on a new constitution that, as you referenced before, really makes some dramatic changes and gains for the indigenous majority of Bolivia?
Depending on how the negotiations go, it could very likely be pushed back. The Constitution is such a heated issue here because it's at the core of changing the balance of power. And although hopefully we'll see some steps forward with this negotiation in the coming week, I think there's a good chance that we'll see that that's going to be put off, hopefully not by violence, but perhaps by more talks and some resistance by both sides. So it's hard to tell right now if that's actually going to come off, as Morales hopes it will.
That was Melissa Draper, Assistant Director of the Democracy Center in Cochabamba, Bolivia. Visit the center's website at democracyctr.org. After a five-year campaign, grassroots activists in Connecticut succeeded in passing a state law in 2002 to clean up the state's six dirtiest power plants, which had been grandfathered in under the Clean Air Act amendments of 1977. Before the effort got underway, it was assumed that the state's oldest and dirtiest coal and oil-burning power plants would soon shut down. But when they didn't, thousands of residents from 130 organizations came together to organize the Sooty Six campaign. The law required the plants to reduce their emissions of sulfur dioxide, commonly known as soot, to the same level as plants built after 1977. 6 years after the law passed, activists from Clean Water Action and the Toxics Action Center crunched the numbers from the Environmental Protection Agency, comparing emissions from 1998 to 2000 with those from 2005 to 2007, and found that there was an astounding overall reduction of 86% in soot levels from the six plants. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Brooke Suter, who co-chaired the campaign when she was director of Clean Water Action in Connecticut. She has since gone on to work as the national campaign director for the Clean Air Task Force. Suter describes the organizing strategy that proved so successful in winning Connecticut's Sooty Six campaign, and how these lessons have been applied to other campaigns around the country.
From the very beginning, the focus was on organizing around the power plant towns, getting community involvement, having the citizen leaders who were really concerned about the impact of this pollution on their health be the leaders and be the ones to talk to the legislators and talk to decision makers and really educate people about what the issues were and the health disbenefits of this kind of pollution. And in addition to organizing around the power plant towns, the Clean Water Action Canvas went door to door in the northern part of the state as well, educating people about this issue. So it really became a statewide issue, and people understood that the people closest to the plants were impacted in a very negative way by this power plant pollution, and also the people across the state were impacted by this sort of pollution coming from the different plants. And everybody rallied behind the need to clean this up, which was really, really wonderful. And the organization and the support behind it grew and grew and grew. 138-plus organizations were signed on in support, rallied around the issue, and really worked to make sure that our decision makers understood how important it was to clean these up. And in the end, everybody was victorious.
Brooke Suter, what got the campaign to the finish line? Was there one specific thing that happened, or did you just reach critical mass?
Well, you know, I think it really was persistence. I think it was being strategic, really focusing on who do we need to talk to, what information do they need. Being right should be enough, but it's usually not. You know, you need to really make sure that decision makers understand fully the issue and understand why it is you're asking for what you're asking for, and making sure that their constituents are up there talking to them and saying, you know, we care about this. This is important to us and our health, and we want you to clean these plants up. One of the things that was most interesting was that all of us were new to being up at the Capitol when we started in 97. One of the things that struck me and struck the citizen leaders was when legislators would say, well, you know, if you get half of it, you should be happy because that's, you know, that's all anybody ever gets. And people said, well, that's just not enough in this case. You know, this is a real health issue, and it can be corrected, and we need to correct it. It's an equity issue. These power plants should not be operating at dirtier levels than other power plants have to operate at. They should be cleaned up. If they're still operating, they should be cleaned up. What was really sort of, I think, surprising to citizens and all of us when we were new to all this was the disinformation that different entities would sort of throw out. There was sort of the Chicken Little scenario where there were radio ads running at one point about how if you had to clean up the Sooty 6 power plants, the electricity would go out in the state and hospitals wouldn't have electricity. And, you know, it was disappointing to see that people would stoop to that level because that clearly wasn't the case and we had the data to prove that.
The percentage reduction of soot is phenomenal. How did the plants achieve it?
It is phenomenal, and they achieved those reductions through a variety of methods. There was fuel switching, so for those plants that used high sulfur oil, they switched to a lower sulfur oil, and they also put on scrubbers. They also have reduced the usage of these more to being peaking power plants, so when there's a really heavy demand, these are used. So really that focus on these plants and the need to clean them up, people feel was significant in moving all of those methods forward. And what's most important now is looking towards conservation and reducing the need for energy, because that then reduces the need for, you know, fossil fuel power plants, for instance, and also promoting renewable energies. So we've had some really, really significant victories here in Connecticut that are important both for Connecticut but also nationally.
So now you're working on clean air at the national level. Are you using any of the strategies that were used successfully in Connecticut?
The Sooty 6 campaign has really been inspirational to people outside of Connecticut as well, to see that grassroots organizing and citizen involvement can really make a difference, and that even with all the obstacles of sort of insider-paid lobbyists and the games that can get played up at the Capitol, you know, with persistence and strategic thinking and commitment from citizens and citizen leaders and ally legislators, you really can win.
That was Brooke Suter, co-chair of the Sooty 6 campaign and currently national campaign director for the Clean Air Task Force. Contact the task force at area code 617-624-0234 or visit their website at catf.us. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Minka Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Ruben Abreu, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.